You know, usually when you think about a 24-hour continuous Zoom call, it sounds like some kind of modern corporate punishment.
Oh, absolutely. It sounds like the ultimate endurance test for human attention spans. I mean, most of us can barely handle a one-hour status update without opening another tab.
Right. You just picture yourself trapped in a little digital box, staring at a ring light, desperately waiting for the moment you can finally hit leave meeting.
I'm just watching the clock.
But imagine filling that exact same 24-hour call with 500 brilliant minds from across the globe. We're talking academics, NGO workers, students, and just everyday people passing the microphone across 24 different time zones.
Like a planetary brainstorm.
Exactly. And their only prompt is to brainstorm the actual future of humanity. Suddenly, that digital box isn't a trap, it's a crystal ball.
The fascinating thing about this setup is that human beings generally love structure. You know, we like our meetings to be organized, to have a really rigid agenda. But this was designed as a totally open space.
Anyone could join, right?
Yeah, anyone with a microphone and an internet connection could step up to the digital podium and just speak their mind about where we are heading.
Welcome to this deep dive into Futures Research Unpacked. Today, we're exploring an incredible empirical study that actually conducted this experiment.
Yeah, the paper is called World Futures Day 2022, a mixed method approach to identify topics of a global futures agenda by DiBerardo, DiZio, and Fontanella.
So the real-world issue these researchers were tackling is how we actually organize global foresight. You know, what is humanity worried about, and what solutions are we dreaming up?
And their research designed to capture this was massive. They basically analyzed a mountain of data from this 24-hour global brainstorm using a mix of qualitative human review and advanced automated text mining.
Which led them to some wild key findings. They distilled all this chatter into four main clusters of our future, from space energy and hyper-technological humanity to how our brains are being rewired and how we actually study foresight as a science.
And of course, these results really force us to interpret the future differently. It challenges this idea that we're all just going to end up in megacities or that the metaverse is a done deal.
Though it wasn't a perfect study, there were definitely some real-world limitations and messy data collection moments that we'll get into. But our mission today is to look at all of this and figure out what these results mean for you as you navigate tomorrow.
It's a huge undertaking.
Okay, let's unpack this. Because comparing your average Tuesday morning meeting to a sleep-deprived, round-the-world brainstorm is just, it's wild.
The logistics alone are staggering. The World Futures Day event kicked off on March 1st in New Zealand right at noon.
Okay.
And from there, every single hour, the conversation moved one time zone west. So it created an open, continuous loop around the globe.
So people could just pop in, listen to what the other side of the planet was talking about, drop an idea, and just leave.
That was the entire premise. They had about 500 unique attendees participate over the course of the day. But hosting the event was actually the easy part.
Right, because then you have to figure out what they said.
Exactly. The real bottleneck for the researchers was figuring out what to do with the aftermath. They recorded everything and ended up with a transcript containing, get this, 169,277 words.
Oh my God. Over 160,000 words of raw, unfiltered human conversation. How do you even begin to find a signal in all that noise? I mean, if I were a researcher reading that much text, I'd probably just end up highlighting the things I already agreed with. Human bias feels inevitable there.
And the researchers knew that. They knew qualitative human interpretation is inherently subjective. So to bypass that bias, they used a mixed methods approach.
Okay, so what did they pair the human analysis with?
Automated text mining, specifically a statistical technique called latent Dirichlet allocation, or LDA for short. And they also layered Geographic Information Systems, GIS, over the data to map how topics shifted by longitude.
Latent Dirichlet allocation. Okay, let's break that down for someone who doesn't spend their weekends reading data science textbooks. What is this tool actually doing to the text?
Right, so instead of a simple keyword search, think of LDA like a reverse engineered recipe.
Every recipe.
Yeah, imagine you're given a massive baked cake, in this case, 160,000 words of human chatter. The LDA algorithm mathematically works backward to figure out exactly how much flour, sugar, and eggs went into the batter.
Oh, I see.
But instead of ingredients, it looks at the mathematical co-occurrence of words to provide an objective probability of what underlying or latent themes are clustering together. It maps out the recipe of the conversation.
So it's essentially a high-tech digital sieve. It shakes out the raw data and leaves behind these concentrated gold nuggets of meaning, like showing us that whenever people talked about oceans, they were also talking about data ownership or whatever the connection might be.
Oh, exactly.
And then the human researchers act as the jewelers, taking those nuggets and giving them actual narrative context.
That captures the dynamic perfectly. The algorithm provides the objective clustering, and the humans provide the contextual why.
So when the researchers passed this mountain of text through their digital sieve, what did the recipe of our future actually look like?
Well, the data sorted itself into several massive themes. And the first major area of concern was all about the physical nuts and bolts of survival. You know, how do we power the world and where do we physically live?
Which makes sense. Physical infrastructure is always going to dominate human concern. But what kind of solutions were they talking about?
They were entirely paradigm shifting. Space futures, for instance, was a massive recurring topic.
Like moving to Mars.
Not just science fiction exploration, no. They were hashing out the economics of space energy. They projected that we could bring electricity costs down to 10 cents a kilowatt hour by harvesting solar power in orbit and beaming it down to Earth.
10 cents? That would fundamentally alter global economics.
Completely. But the conversation got even more granular than just orbital solar panels. They dug into specific real-world engineering bottlenecks. Like, a major talking point was the NASA Glenn Research Center's work on a regenerative solar hydrogen system.
Wait, what makes that specific system so critical?
So, the primary bottleneck for building a permanent lunar base isn't just getting there, it's surviving the lunar night.
Oh, because it gets incredibly cold.
Cold, yes, but also dark.
Yeah.
A single night on the moon lasts for about 14 Earth days.
14 days of straight darkness.
Right.
Yeah.
So solar panels are completely useless during that two-week stretch. And launching enough traditional batteries to power a base for 14 days is far too heavy and expensive to put on a rocket.
So how do you keep the lights and heaters on for 2 weeks in the dark?
You use a closed-loop chemical process. During the 14 days of sunlight, solar panels power an electrolyzer that splits lunar water into hydrogen and oxygen gas. You store those gases. Then, when the two-week night falls, you feed that hydrogen and oxygen into a fuel cell to generate electricity. And the byproduct of that reaction is water.
Wow.
Which you capture and use to start the entire process over when the sun finally comes up again.
That is brilliant. It's literally bottling the sun to survive the dark.
Yeah.
It is incredible how practical this planetary brainstorm got.
It really was. But they didn't just look up at the moon. They spent a lot of time analyzing where you and I are living right now on Earth. The data showed a huge focus on eco-smart cities.
Now, the legacy assumption in foresight studies was always that humanity was inevitably moving toward megacities, right? Like, the old projection was, what, 7 billion people crammed into massive urban centers by 2050?
Exactly. But the text mining revealed a massive pivot in global thinking. Driven by the pandemic and the rapid normalization of remote work technology, the consensus shifted toward building smaller, self-sustaining communities.
The theory being that you no longer need the physical infrastructure of a massive city to participate in the global economy.
Right. You can live anywhere.
But I have to push back on this eco-smart city utopia a bit. Because if all these high-earning tech workers abandon the megacities and move out to smaller, remote communities with their laptops, are we actually solving the resource drain of cities?
That's a very fair point.
Or are we just turning quiet rural towns into highly gentrified Disneylands for remote workers, effectively pricing out the local populations?
And that exact tension was heavily debated in the transcripts. The participants recognized that simply installing smart tech in a rural town doesn't solve the social fabric issues.
Yeah, it just changes the zip code of the problem.
Exactly. If you don't redesign the governance of these spaces, you just export urban inequality to the countryside. And that leads directly into how we force our governments to plan for these shifts. A major concept that emerged here was the use of commitment devices.
Commitment devices. That sounds like a wearable fitness tracker, but for politicians.
It acts very much like one, honestly. But it's a legal mechanism. The participants looked at places like New Zealand, which uses substantive commitment devices to force long-term ecological and fiscal sustainability.
How does the mechanism actually work? Because politicians break promises literally all the time.
That's the beauty of the device. Instead of a politician merely promising to cut emissions to win an election, you know, a promise they can just abandon when it becomes politically inconvenient, a commitment device legally binds the office itself to a specific budget or goal.
Oh, I see.
It institutes a duty of stewardship. If the government fails to meet the milestones, it triggers automatic predefined penalties or policy shifts, regardless of which political party is currently in power. It totally removes the short-term incentive to kick the can down the road.
So you are hard-coding long-term consequences into the law itself. That makes total sense. But of course, if we're redesigning our cities and legally binding our governments to the future, we have to talk about the citizens inhabiting those cities.
And according to the data, those citizens might not all be entirely biological.
Right. This is where the brainstorm moved into what they categorized as a hyper-technological humanity.
Yes, the conversation tackled how we integrate with advanced machinery, grounded in current technological signals. And a prime example that participants heavily focused on was a robot named Grace.
Grace, the humanoid robot. I've seen videos of this. She's considered the beta daughter of the famous Sophia robot, right?
That's the one. The participants discussed Grace's specific capabilities. She speaks multiple languages, uses thermal cameras and sensors to recognize and diagnose her owners, and she can even extend her body on a tripod to walk in fashion shows.
Extending on a tripod is quite the visual, but I'm assuming they weren't just talking about her as a runway novelty.
No, the primary application discussed for Grace was actually as an elder companion.
An elder companion?
Yeah. In nations like South Korea, where the fertility rate has fallen drastically, there simply aren't enough young people to care for the aging population. So robots like Grace are being actively developed to fill the gap of loneliness, hold conversations, and provide basic medical monitoring for the elderly.
I really struggle with this concept. I mean, the engineering is miraculous, obviously, but look at the mechanism of what we are doing. Is programming an algorithm to mimic empathy, to just nod and smile at an isolated elderly person, actually solving the human crisis of loneliness? Or are we just outsourcing our basic human duty to care for one another to machines because it's economically easier?
You are hitting on the exact ethical boundary of transhumanism, which dominated this segment of the text data. The debate wasn't just about robots caring for us. It was about us merging with the technology.
Merging how?
Well, the transcripts pointed to massive empirical investments in synthetic biology, like Jeff Bezos investing $3 billion into rejuvenation technologies.
Rejuvenation as in literally trying to reverse human aging?
Yes. They cited Ray Kurzweil's famous prediction that we could achieve functional rejuvenation technology for everybody by the year 2045.
Wait, 2045 is barely two decades away. But if billionaires are pouring billions into making people live until they're 150, who actually gets access to that? It feels like we're building this hyper-advanced immortal future, but we're running it on societal structures and algorithms that are heavily flawed today.
The study captured that exact fear. The researchers categorized these anxieties under the theme of cyber dictatorship.
Cyber dictatorship? That's bleak.
Very. The participants pointed out the brittleness of current AI. The empirical data shows we are building massive decision-making systems, yet there are documented racial and gender biases embedded deeply in the algorithms.
Right, because humans program them.
Exactly. The global brainstorm highlighted a severe lack of transparency in big tech, where machine learning model building is basically treated as a proprietary dark art, totally free from public oversight.
So if these algorithms are biased and we are moving more of our lives into digital spaces, who controls the rules of those spaces? Everyone throws around the word metaverse, but the participants in this study kept using a different term, didn't they?
They did. They heavily advocated for the pluriverse.
Okay, explain the pluriverse like I'm 5 years old. What is the difference?
So the metaverse, as it's currently discussed by big tech, is essentially envisioned as a digital mega mall owned and governed by one massive corporation.
Like a walled garden.
Right. The rules, the physics, the commerce, they're all dictated centrally. The pluriverse, on the other hand, is more like the actual internet, a decentralized web of different interconnected digital worlds.
Oh, I see.
It's the idea that virtual environments shouldn't be a single homogeneous corporate product,
right,
but a diverse ecosystem where local cultures and communities actually govern their own spaces and rules.
That makes a lot of sense, because the participants feared that a centrally controlled metaverse could become an escapist playground, or even worse, a venue for unmonitored digital harm where users have zero democratic recourse.
Exactly. The pluriverse is a conceptual framework to negotiate against digital colonialism. It allows for the co-creation of multiple futures, rather than forcing everyone into a single Silicon Valley paradigm.
But if we are going to be navigating a pluriverse, and living alongside AI companions, and managing smart cities, we have to look at what this technology is doing to our own biological hardware in the meantime. We are demanding so much more from our brains.
which brings us to the findings around education and human cognition. And the data here was incredibly sobering. One of the most prominent topics that Digital Civ extracted was stolen focus.
Stolen focus. You know, think about how you consumed information today. Did you actually learn something by engaging with it? Or did you just scroll through a few bullet points on a screen, instantly forgetting them?
The global consensus in the transcripts was that our current implementation of technology is actively diminishing our cognitive abilities. We are outsourcing our memory and our complexity to our phones, and it is drastically shortening our attention spans.
And the paper explicitly points this out as a global crisis. The participants were warning against proposing massive tech infrastructure ramp-ups in the global south without instituting safeguards.
Yeah, because if they don't, developing nations will suffer the exact same loss of focus and cognitive fragmentation that the global north is currently wrestling with.
So how did they propose we fix it?
To combat this, the Brainstorm participants argued that we need to fundamentally restructure how we learn. They advocated a shift toward experiential learning.
Meaning what, exactly?
Well, the argument is that our current education systems heavily favor the rational, semantic left brain. We teach people to memorize discrete facts and pass multiple-choice tests.
But the researchers found that outsourcing our memory to search engines breaks that model. If you can Google any fact in 3 seconds, semantic learning completely loses its value.
Precisely. The participants argued we need to reconnect with the experiential right brain. We need to teach self-learning, creativity, and the ability to synthesize high-level models. If you only have semantic facts without the experiential ability to connect them, you just lose your practical connection to reality.
And a core part of that new educational model is making futuring a basic skill for everyone. I think of futuring as a muscle.
I like that analogy.
Yeah, it isn't some abstract concept you only learn by getting a master's degree in strategic foresight. It's a daily cognitive practice. If your focus is constantly being stolen by algorithms, you have to actively work out your ability to envision the long term.
They actually discuss practical tools for this, like having students write postcards from the future to practice visioning and build emotional connections to long-term consequences.
Postcards from the future, I love that.
And what's fascinating is how the LDA algorithm validated this intense focus on cognition. When the researchers reviewed the automated text mining, one of the most massive recurring data clusters was labeled brain and complex models.
Wow.
And it spiked heavily at the beginning of the 24-hour call and again at the end.
Now, when they were talking about the brain, were they literally just discussing human biology and neuroscience?
No, and this is where the human interpretation of the data becomes vital. The researchers realized that the brain had evolved into a global metaphor during the call.
A metaphor.
Yeah, people from vastly different cultures were using the concept of the human brain to describe global networks, digital communication, and complex planetary systems.
So the planetary brainstorm literally started talking about the planet as a brain.
Exactly.
That is a beautiful full circle moment. But it raises a critical question about the people leading this charge. Who are the people trying to build this global futuring muscle? And is this practice actually a science?
The paper notes a fascinating historical transition here. A decade ago, calling yourself a futurist was almost seen as a quirky hobby or something reserved for science fiction authors.
Right, like staring into a literal crystal ball.
Exactly. But today, the data shows it has transitioned into a vanguard empirical profession. But it's crucial to understand that strategic foresight is not physics.
Right, because if you know the mass and velocity of a comet, you can use physics to predict exactly where it will be in 100 years. But you absolutely cannot use math to predict the stock market or human behavior next week.
And that limitation is due to chaos theory and the nature of complex systems. Because human society involves millions of interacting variables and emergent properties, you can never predict the exact future. Instead, the discipline is built on surprise theory.
Surprise theory?
Yes. It is about anticipating alternative futures.
Okay, here's where it gets really interesting. I have to stop you there because the logic feels contradictory.
How so?
Well, if chaos theory mathematically proves we absolutely cannot predict the future, what is the point of having a surprise theory? If a surprise is, by definition, unpredictable, isn't studying it an oxymoron?
It sounds like a paradox, I know, but the participants laid out a really clear distinction. While you cannot predict the exact timing or nature of an event, you can study the anatomy of surprises.
You mean anatomy?
Yeah, it can analyze why human systems consistently miss warning signs. Foresight isn't about predicting that a specific pandemic will arrive on a specific Tuesday in March. No. It is about understanding the vulnerabilities of global supply chains so that when a disruptive event inevitably occurs, society has the flexibility and resilience to react immediately.
So you're mapping the fault lines even if you can't predict the exact earthquake.
Exactly. And one of the most effective ways they build that societal flexibility is by treating scenarios as literature.
Meaning using science fiction as an empirical tool.
Yes, because dry statistics about a 2-degree rise in global temperatures do not move human beings to action. Our brains just aren't wired for it.
No, we just tune it out.
But narrative storytelling, you know, books like Kim Stanley Robinson's The Ministry for the Future or films like Don't Look Up, that builds an emotional, experiential connection to those dry statistics. It forces the right brain to engage with the data.
But as much as we are praising this global brainstorm, we do have to be honest about the real-world constraints of this study. The paper explicitly outlines how messy this research design actually was in practice. It was not a pristine laboratory experiment.
Oh, it was incredibly chaotic. Because they prioritized an open democratic space, the Zoom call was actually hit by coordinated cyber attacks.
Wow, really?
Yeah, Zoom bombers, which forced the organizers to temporarily close off access.
Which kind of defeats the open door policy.
Right. And you also had the classic human element. Dominant talkers from certain regions monopolizing time slots, which obviously skewed the data. Furthermore, the automated transcription software occasionally failed to understand different accents, leaving these blank, unanalyzable spots in the transcript.
And even that highly objective digital LDA tool, it has a human flaw built into it, doesn't it?
It does. The algorithm doesn't inherently know how many themes exist in the text. The human researchers have to tell it how many topics to look for.
So there's still bias.
It requires highly subjective tuning. If you tell the algorithm to find too few topics, the results are too broad to be useful. If you tell it to find 50 topics, the data fragments into microscopic nonsense.
So how did they solve that?
The researchers had to carefully calibrate the tool, eventually settling on 10 automated topics that aligned with their qualitative analysis, just to find the analytical sweet spot.
Which is a perfect metaphor for the entire field, honestly. Studying the future is just as messy, subjective, and prone to sudden cyber attacks as the future itself.
It's an imperfect science, but an absolutely necessary one.
So we've covered an immense amount of ground today. We've seen how 500 minds spread across 24 time zones used a mix of automated data science and human intuition to basically map the trajectory of our species.
We really went everywhere.
Yeah, we've gone from the mechanical logistics of regenerative fuel cells on the moon to the deeply intimate ethical questions of deploying AI robots to care for our elderly. We've looked at the battle to reclaim our biological attention spans from algorithms and the push to make futuring a daily cognitive habit rather than just a parlor trick.
And if there is a core takeaway from analyzing these 160,000 words, it is that the future isn't a weather event that just happens to us. It is a commodity that we are actively purchasing right now. Every piece of legislation, every technological investment, and every second of focus you give to a screen is a down payment on the reality we will inhabit tomorrow.
And that leaves us with a final lingering question for you to mull over as you go about your day. We talked about transhumanism, the push for rejuvenation tech and DNA manipulation by 2045.
Yeah.
If that actually becomes a reality, then we can biologically extend human life. What happens to those who are left behind? Could the biggest geopolitical divide of tomorrow not be between nations or economies, but between a new class of genetically enhanced transhumans and those who choose or are simply forced by economics to remain purely biological?
It is a profound species-altering cliff we are rapidly approaching.
The next time you are stuck in a seemingly endless video call staring at a grid of tired faces, just remember, you aren't just in a meeting. You are looking at a tiny piece of the planetary brain. The only question is, what future are you all building together? Thanks for joining us on this deep dive. See you next time.